Welcome to the Reformed Media Review. This is episode number 137. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois, back with Ryan Noah, a director of Reformed Academy and general book expert. Welcome back, Ryan. It's good to see you.
You flatter me, brother, but it's great to be back. Always enjoy talking books.
Well, you know what's up, and certainly running an online bookstore and just having a wide knowledge and understanding of what's out there. You certainly point a whole bunch of things in my direction and things I wouldn't have known about otherwise. Today is going to be one of our On the Radar episodes where we look at a bunch of forthcoming titles, notable items. These are not exhaustive reviews or treatments. We try to mix it up here on the program. Sometimes we just letting you know about some upcoming titles. Other times we do a deeper dive and a review of books with someone who's read the entire volume critically and has a few things to say constructively. And then sometimes, as best as possible, with the books we really are interested in, we'll speak with people and interview them at depth and at length on Christ the Center. So sometimes we'll hit them all. You can hit the trifecta, maybe. So today we've got a bunch of books that are worth hearing about. And as we read about them, tell you a little bit about them and read the publisher's description, you can follow up through the links on our website or head on over to the publisher's website yourself and find out more information. Maybe look up some other interviews, maybe find some online reviews, or just buy the book and start at it. We look forward to that. Sometimes, in some cases, the publishers might also publish a sample chapter. And if they're available on Kindle, I think any book that's available on Kindle lets you get the first chapter, at least. So those are other ways to get a jump start on what's out there. Why don't I start with the first one we have by James Durham, Commentary on Revelation, Volume 2, Lectures on Chapters 4 through 11. So there's going to be more than two volumes.
Yeah, I don't know how many are projected, but at least three. You can't stop at Revelation.
Can't stop at 11. Oh man!
Unless, of course, he didn't finish them. But I'm almost positive this is a full commentary on Revelation to come.
Good point. This is published by Reformation Heritage Books, May 21, 504 pages, $50 hardcover. And Puritanism in the 17th century has had many shining lights, and of these, James Durham, 1622 to 1658, ranks alongside the greatest for his theological depth, faithful preaching, and moderate spirit. Durham's exposition on Revelation contains treatises of the purest of theological gold, with extended essays on the Trinity, the call to the ministry, the nature of justification, and more. It is Reformed thought at its best and has been valued through history. His contemporary, Robert Blair, said, "Many writers have done worthily, but thou excellest them all." C.H. Spurgeon said, "It would not be easy to find a more sensible and instructive work than this." So if you're interested in historical works, and we all ought to be, certainly Reformation Heritage Books continues their long track record and notable publications here by publishing James Durham on Revelation, Commentary on Revelation, Volume 2, Lectures on Chapters 4 through 11. Interesting.
Next up, we have a book by Oz Guinness, The Magna Carta of Humanity, Sinai's Revolutionary Faith and the Future of Freedom. This is published by IVP Academic, May 2021, 288 pages, $25, hardcover with jacket. This is a great description. I love it when publishers really, go all out for the descriptions. In these stormy times, loud voices from all fronts call for revolution and change. But what kind of revolution brings true freedom to both society and the human soul? Cultural observer Oz Guinness explores the nature of revolutionary faith, contrasting between secular revolutions such as the French Revolution and the faith-led revolution of ancient Israel. He argues that the story of Exodus is the richest, highest, and deepest vision for freedom in human history. It serves as the master story of human freedom and provides the greatest sustained critique of the abuse of power. His contrast between Paris and Sinai offers a framework for discerning between two kinds of revolution and their different views of human nature, equality, and liberty. Drawing on the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, Guinness develops Exodus as the Magna Carta of humanity, with a constructive vision of a morally responsible society of independent, free people who are covenanted to each other and to justice, peace, stability, and the common good of the community. This is the model from the past that charts our path to the future.
Wow.
That's got my my Kyperian anti-revolutionary party spirit boiling in my veins, brother. This just sounds wonderful, thinking about how God's law really is a law of liberty,
mm-hmm.
And all else leads to tyranny. This will preach. I look forward to reading this book. Oz Guinness has done some good work on Christ and culture in the vein of a Francis Schaeffer, if you will.
Yeah. Definitely, he's written quite a bit, and it's always worth hearing his comment. And so this is just, I don't know what to say. It's just, you don't see books like this.
Right.
Like, anymore. I mean, this is a big, it's an ambitious volume, and I like that. You know, it kind of reminds me of some of the reasons why I like continental philosophy. I'm more interested in continental philosophy in general, just as even a casual reader, than I am to analytic philosophy, because they just wrestle with the big issues, the big questions, rather than having a hyper precise issue and trying to be entirely exhaustive with it. You get some of these philosophers that are just dealing with the huge issues. Now, maybe they aren't as precise and get down to all the details, but I'm not saying anything about Guinness or this volume, but it's of the stripe. It's cut from the cloth of, we're talking here about, you know, Exodus as the Magna Carta of humanity.
Right.
Okay, that's just enormous. It's a big undertaking.
Sure.
So it'd be interesting to read. Take a look at that. We have next Michael J. Lynch, John Davenant's Hypothetical Universalism, A Defense of Catholic and Reformed Orthodoxy. Now, this is with Oxford Studies in Historical Theology series. We've discussed several books in that series. Published by Oxford University Press, coming in June 2021, 272 pages, $99, hardcover. Recently, there has been a revival of interest in the views held by Reformed theologians within the parameters of confessional orthodoxy. For example, the doctrine known as hypothetical universalism, the idea that although Christ died in some sense for every person, his death was intended to bring about the salvation only for those who were predestined for salvation. Michael Lynch focuses on the hypothetical universalism of the English theologian and bishop John Davenant, 1572 to 1641, arguing that it has consistently been misinterpreted and misrepresented as a via media between Arminian and Reformed theology. So this is certainly something that pops up quite a bit lately, and you think about the work and the interests of the Davenant Institute. They published quite a few books recently, Michael Lynch involved with them. So certainly worthwhile, and most all the books, at least the ones I've seen in this series, are all worthy titles worth discussing. So certainly something to take a look at. Have you seen this one or done much reading on this subject?
No, I haven't at all. The reason why I was thinking about this one was from your interview with Dr. Harrison Perkins when you talked about James Usher and
right.
And also just exploring the question of what are the boundaries, what are the parameters of what constitutes confessional Reformed orthodoxy?
Sure. Well, it also raises the issue, particularly with the divines, the people involved in writing the Westminster Standards. There are several layers of questions that have different applicability for us today. You know, as historical theologians, we can go back and wonder, okay, well, what were the views of the people involved? Then we can ask questions of what views are tolerated by the Westminster Standards? What views were negotiated so that there would be room within the standards for certain views and maybe not others? I'm not seeking to answer any of those questions at the moment, but these are all the kinds of things that are raised when we start to deal with subjects such as this and hypothetical universalism. Do the Westminster Standards allow it? Do they promote it? Do they forbid it? If you're interested in those kinds of questions, and this is the kind of book you ought to be reading, and not just this book, but then following up with reading the primary sources and trying to understand them on their own terms. John Davenant here. Michael Lynch certainly done a tremendous amount of work on that subject. Next up, we have one by Stephen Hampton, huh?
Yes, it's from Stephen Hampton. Great. This is also in the same series, the Oxford Studies in History Theology series, or Historical Theology. I believe it is. This is Grace and Conformity, the Reformed Conformist Tradition, and the Early Stuart Church of England. Oxford University Press, due out in June 2021, 424 pages, $99 in hardcover. The Reformed Conformity that flourished within the early Stuart English Church was a rich, vibrant, and distinctive theological tradition that has never before been studied in its own right. While scholars have observed how Reformed Conformists clashed with Laudians and Puritans alike, no sustained academic study of their teaching on grace and their attitude to the church has yet been undertaken, despite the centrality of these topics to early Stuart theological controversy. This groundbreaking monograph recovers this essential strand of early Stuart Christian identity. It examines and analyzes the teachings and writings of 10 prominent theologians, all of whom made significant contributions to the debates that arose within the Church of England during the reigns of James I and Charles I, and all of whom combined loyalty to Orthodox Reformed teaching on grace and salvation with a commitment to the established polity of the English Church. I love that he's seeking to study this often overlooked tradition on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I think of, I know practically nothing about early Stuart Reformed conformity or orthodoxy, but what right. little I know is through the lens of the Puritans and those who were nonconformists, you know, whether it be someone like John Bunyan, who all he had to do was say, okay, I'll go get a license in the Church of England and then I could preach, or someone else, you know.
Well, we have a third one in the title or in the series, if I'm not mistaken, this one by Michael W. Bruning, Refusing to Kiss the Slipper. I would think that was something you wrote, Ryan.
Oh, I love that title. Brother, I'm so sorry. I set you up poorly. The full title, I mean, that'll stand, Refusing to Kiss the Slipper. But the subtitle is Opposition to Calvinism in the Francophone Reformation.
I know. This is like, right, you got to introduce this one. This is right okay. up your alley.
Oh,
but,
sure. This is also from the same Oxford Studies in History, Oxford University Press, June 2021. 384 pages, $99 in hardcover. History has long viewed French Protestants as Calvinists. Refusing to Kiss the Slipper re-examines the Reformation in Francophone Europe, presenting for the first time the perspective of John Calvin's evangelical enemies and revealing that the French Reformation was more complex and colorful than previously recognized. Michael Bruning brings together a cast of Calvin's opponents from various French-speaking territories to show that opposition to Calvinism was stronger and better organized than has been recognized. He examines individual opponents such as Pierre Caroli, Jérôme Bolzec, Sébastien Castiello, Charles Dumoulin, and Jean Morelli. More importantly, he explores the anti-Calvinist networks that developed around such individuals. Now, back when I was in seminary at Mid-America Reform Seminary,
there you go.
I had the pleasure of writing a paper for Dr. Venema on John Calvin's controversy with Pierre Caroli and how that helped him to develop and strengthen his doctrine of Jesus Christ as autotheos.
Mm.
And Caroli, he was, as Calvin would say, he was a calumniator of the highest order. And I trust that we'll learn more about him in this book and all
wow.
these other guys. But yeah, the opposition was fierce and political. I mean, they're not just throwing tracts back and forth. There's
oh, man.
Heads are on the line, really.
Oh,
so
it's always at stake. No, it's good. I appreciate you can shift into the French mode. We're speaking about Francophone Europe, so
oh,
you can
yeah.
bring the right pronunciations to these names.
That's
rather
fun.
Than this guy from the Midwest, although you're from the Midwest too, but spent time living. Where'd you live? Near Lyon?
I lived in Clermont-Ferrand. It's the home of Michelin tires.
Yeah.
And where they launched the first crusade. Pope Urban, either the first or the second. Pope Urban launched the first crusade from there.
Yeah, claim to fame.
Yes.
Next up, we have David Pallison, the pastor as counselor, The Call for Soul Care, Crossway, June 21. 80 pages, $7.99, paperback. A pastor inhabits multiple roles, teacher, preacher, youth leader, and counselor, and yet many church leaders feel unprepared to counsel church members struggling with any number of difficult multifaceted problems, whether from a lack of training, inexperience, or both. This book by David Pallison, an experienced counselor and the former executive director of the Christian Counseling and Educational Foundation, reminds pastors of their unique role as the shepherds of God's people, tasked with applying biblical wisdom to the thoughts, values, moods, expectations, and decisions of those under their care. So this is published posthumously. I knew David. I wouldn't say I knew him exceedingly well, but I worked with him. I worked at the Christian Counseling and Educational Foundation for a couple of years when I was in seminary. I was just doing IT support. But certainly while I was an MDiv student at the seminary, I was taking classes and would always pick David's brain whenever I was able. He was always so good-natured and just a kind and compassionate guy. And, you know, I suspect that there are multitudes of books waiting in his notes and lectures and whatnot, even those that he's left behind as he's now gone to glory. I wonder exactly what the story is behind this particular volume, but I trust that it's well worthwhile, and even more certainly as applicable today as when David was probably sketching these things out. So the pastor as counselor, the call for soul care, very essential. So very thankful for his ministry, and look forward to reading more from him, even as he's the Lord's taken him.
Amen.
What do we have
next? Up, we have another one from Oxford Studies in Historical Theology. This is by K.J. Drake, The Flesh of the Word, the Extra-Calvinisticum from Zwingli to Early Orthodoxy. It's from OUP, June 2021, 328 pages, $99 in hardcover. The Extra-Calvinisticum, and it's going to define it, if any are
I'm already excited.
Not aware of that doctrine. Yeah, here we go. The Extra-Calvinisticum, the doctrine that the Eternal Son maintains his existence beyond the flesh, both during his earthly ministry and perpetually, divided the Lutheran and Reformed traditions during the Reformation. This book explores the emergence and development of the Extra-Calvinisticum in Reformed tradition by tracing its first exposition from Ulrich Zwingli to early Reformed Orthodoxy. Rather than being an ancillary issue, the questions surrounding the Extra-Calvinisticum were a determinative factor in the differentiation of magisterial Protestantism into rival confessions. Reformed theologians maintained this doctrine in order to preserve the integrity of both Christ's divine and human natures as the mediator between God and humanity. This rationale remained consistent across this period, with increasing elaboration and sophistication to meet the challenges leveled against the doctrine in Lutheran polemics.
Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, the name Extra-Calvinisticum was coined by Lutherans as a polemic. It was like a put-down in the Calvinists, modern day, but I think even at the contemporary times, were they took it as a compliment. Said, yes, right. Exactly. This is what we believe is correct. So certainly this will be interesting as an historical work. Oxford continues to put out the good stuff. So I'm, you know, just sign me up, subscribe me to this series and send me them all. I mean, that's the way at least I feel every time they come out with a title.
Right.
I think, wow, that's interesting. I wouldn't have even thought about that. And I absolutely want to read this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is cutting edge stuff. This is original research. I don't know anyone who's written a whole book on the Extra-Calvinisticum and traced it from Zwingli onwards.
Absolutely.
Very excited for this.
So we have a next one by, if I'm not mistaken, Jonty Rhodes, Man of Sorrows, King of Glory, What the Humiliation and Exaltation of Jesus Mean for Us, Crossway, 2021, 160 pages, $17.99 paperback. Evangelicals, rightly called people of the cross, look to Jesus' death and resurrection as the central points of his earthly mission. However, many Christians have questions about these pivotal events and what followed. Why did Jesus rise from the dead? Why did he ascend into heaven? What is he doing now? In Man of Sorrows, King of Glory, Jonty Rhodes uses the traditional roles of Jesus as prophet, priest, and king, often referred to as his threefold office, and his humiliation at the cross and exaltation at the resurrection, often referred to as his two states, we could say two estates, to address these questions. As believers explore Jesus' life, death, resurrection, and ascension, they will develop a deeper appreciation for God's plan to reclaim sinners. Very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. Certainly interesting.
Yeah, have you ever read his God's Covenants Made Simple?
No.
I forget who published it. But this, I trust that this is a similar book in that it's a popular treatment that'd be good to give to someone who's new to Reformed theology or someone who just wants to go deeper into our confessional theology. You can see he's not using all the lingo, you know, but he's talking about the two estates, humiliation, yeah. exaltation, his threefold office.
Yeah.
He's a member of the International Presbyterian Church
over
in Leeds, over in the UK.
Oh, Leeds.
Yeah, so this will be a Westminsterian presentation of Christology.
Brilliant.
Sounds excellent. This next book, I beg forgiveness of the author. I'm going to struggle with this one.
It's not French.
No. Balazs M. Meze. B-L-A-Z-S. Et al. So there are other editors as well.
That's not his name.
No, that's not. Oh, yeah.
And others. I'd say Balazs Meze.
Balazs Meze. We'll wonderful.
Is that Turkish? What is that? The Middle Eastern? The Z-S's.
Yeah, I don't know. I tried to put the accent on that second A. But
yeah, it either seems Eastern European to me or perhaps, I don't know, something going on there.
I'm not sure. This book might be a bit off the beaten path.
We're so rude. Not rude, but so uninformed. We apologize.
We did beg forgiveness, and I was sincere.
Yeah, of course.
This book is called The Oxford Handbook of Divine Revelation, OUP, June 2021. 736 pages, $145 in hardcover. The Oxford Handbook of Divine Revelation offers a systemic approach to the notion of revelation in its various theoretical contexts. It provides in-depth coverage of the theoretical and historical fields in which the notion of revelation is discussed. It does not reflect the views of a certain school. Under the horizon of contemporary discussions, it offers the broadest understanding of the notion. Its main parts include biblical, theological, philosophical, historical, comparative, and scientific cultural approaches. The contributors discuss the most important contemporary questions in theology, philosophy, and science. The handbook offers a unique overview of the key problems in Revelation, an overview missing from scholarly literature. Featuring contributions from leading scholars, the collection opens up further possibilities of scholarly work and spiritual vistas concerning the notion and the fact of divine revelation.
Mm. So the author, Meze, this is what I was intending, not Turkish, but it's Hungarian, which makes total sense to me. So he has been a visiting professor at Notre Dame, but at least at one point in time, chair of the Department of Philosophy at a Catholic university in Hungary. So thankful for that. Very international there, and certainly no doubt many international scholars involved in that particular handbook. Very well worthwhile. Last one we'll cover today by Gary Lee Steward, Justifying Revolution, the Early American Clergy and Political Resistance, Oxford University Press, 21. 224 pages, $74 hardcover. Historians have debated how the clergy's support for political resistance during the American Revolution should be understood, often looking to influence outside of the clergy's tradition. This book argues, however, that the position of the patriot clergy was in continuity with a long-standing tradition of Protestant resistance. Drawing from a wide range of sources, Justifying Revolution, the American Clergy's Argument for Political Resistance, 1750 to 1776, answers the question of why so many American clergymen found it morally and ethically right to support resistance to British political authority by exploring the theological background and rich Protestant history available to the American clergy as they considered political resistance and wrestled with the best course of action for them and their congregations. Gary L. Steward argues that rather than deviating from their inherited modes of thought, the clergy who supported resistance did so in ways that were consistent with their own theological tradition. So we've discussed some of that in the past.
Yeah, you can check out our interview with Dr. William Redinger on an article that he published in, I forget what journal, But we also had
it was the University of Chicago.
Yeah, that's right.
At least it was the publisher of it. I don't recall the specific name of the publication, but the link to that will be in the episode description for that interview. And yeah, Jeff Waddington is certainly interested in this field.
Yes. Yeah. Dr. Gary Stewart's done some great work on old Princeton as well.
Mm.
He's got a book, The Princeton Seminary. What's the subtitle? It's Leaders, Lives, and Works, 1812 to 1929. And that's a good one that I worked through years
and that's
ago.
That's when Princeton ended.
Wow. Yeah. Throwing a little barb in there, but that's all right. We're Masons, warrior children.
It's just the way that title read. It was funny. It just sounded as if it stopped in 29, but kind of did. Certainly the Princeton Seminary was reorganized from a board of directors and a board of trustees, where they took a third for a new group. They took a third of that new group from the board of directors, a third from the board of trustees, and a third from new people. And the new balance of power slipped away from the board of directors, if I'm not mistaken, who was viewed by the middle, by the moderates, not the liberals necessarily, but even conservatives, the conservative middle, the mediating figures. They thought the board of directors at Old Princeton was too conservative, too backwards, and they wanted the seminary to reflect the church as a whole. That's what J. Ross Stevenson, the president, wanted, and that's eventually what they got. So they weren't necessarily trying to turn the seminary into a liberal place, a modernist place, but that's kind of how it ended up. And so once the seminary was reorganized, Machen and others left and formed Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. So that's a history that no doubt is well known to many of you, but if not, certainly you can read books like, Fighting the Good Fight. You can read also the book that we just reviewed briefly. Lane Tipton and I discussed Leffert's Lecher, The Broadening Church, which was interesting. That's a mediating perspective. It's not in favor of Machen, but neither is it necessarily a modernist history or a modernist perspective on the history. So Leffert's Lecher, there's a book to that. And I'll try to remember to put a link to that in the episode description as well. Anything else this week? Are we going to save the rest? I guess the next ones are quarter three, no doubt, coming
That's
up
right.
a little bit later in the year.
Yeah, we'll wait on those. But in the meantime, check us out on reformforum.org. Visit our Reformed Academy, too. We've got our Van Til's Trinitarian Theology in full swing. We're very pleased to have another cohort going through the material. This week we have Van Til's Constructive Context of Old Amsterdam on deck. We have new publications coming out very soon from Dr. Tipton.
Man,
so
lots of stuff.
Stay tuned.
We have our own books, yes. Second print run of Danny Olinger's biography of Gerhardus Voss should be arriving as far as this comes out any week. And then also Lane Tipton's book, Foundations of Covenant Theology, a biblical theological study of Genesis 1 through 3. And then at least three, maybe four other books in the works that are in various states of completion that are going to take some time to get out there. But there's a lot going on. ReformedForum.org. Sign up for the email newsletter and you'll hear about all of these things as they come out. But until next time, we encourage you, tolle lege, take up and read.